Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So this is obviously a talk about Anscombe. But of course, you can't ever just give a talk about Anscombe, because Anscombe, like all the rest of us, have been influenced by various people. And if you really want to understand someone, you have to understand their influences. And those of you who know something about Anscombe may know that there were really two philosophers who had an outsized influence on Anscombe. One of these was Thomas Aquinas, the other was Wittgenstein. And this is, of course, a lecture for the Thomistic Institute, and so we're really going to be focusing here on the Wittgensteinian influences on the thought of Anscombe. That's only sort of a joke, right? It's a joke in this sense. In fact, Anscombe's conclusions about ethics really are Thomistic in character, or at least Thomistic in flavor. She's going to agree with Aquinas about an awful lot about what it is that we can and cannot do. But the way she gets there is going to be in a much more Wittgensteinian way, at least in this respect, that when you read Aquinas, you kind of know what his conclusions are and what he's doing. But when you read Anscombe, it's often rather difficult to figure that out. And the reason is because you approach a text of Anscombe with the assumption that she's going to answer your question. And so you read her, and you're like, I mean, I think I get how this answers the question, but like, I don't really get it. And you won't understand what's going on until you realize that when you read Anscombe, much like when you read Wittgenstein, the goal is not always to answer your question, but sometimes to get you to realize you were asking the wrong question, that your question was in some very deep way confused. And this characterizes an awful lot of Anscombe's work. I have a list here of questions that cross her works in metaphysics, philosophy of language, ethics, etc. You won't understand what she's trying to do until you realize that while everyone else thought these were the questions we were trying to answer, she was trying to say, stop asking this question. It has led you astray. What do you have to add to an action to make that act intentional? Normally, I would sort of, you know, digress here for a minute, but you all have John Schwenkler here in your philosophy program, and he would be much more articulate about exactly why Anscombe wants to reject that question than I would be. What is the word I refer to? This is another one I might digress on, except I don't understand Anscombe's paper in the first person. It is very confusing. Why do I persist as the same person across my whole human life? Again, I'll leave that one if you want to know more to John Schwenkler. At what point in development does a human being become a person? Right here you can start to hopefully see why this question might at first really grip us as significant, but also why, especially if you come from a Catholic background, you might think this question is actually deeply pernicious in various ways and smuggles in assumptions that we absolutely do not want to admit. But what's interesting is where a lot of Catholic bioethicists will come to this question and say, well, hang on, the answer is right at conception. And it's going to say, no, right? To answer the question that way, to try to get the conclusion you want out of your Catholic bioethics, is actually going to be a very dishonest thing, because Catholic bioethics properly interpreted will not answer the question at all, because the question itself has already smuggled in assumptions that don't make sense. And it becomes very dangerous when you try to answer the question to get the right conclusion, because you're going to very quickly end up talking nonsense, and you're eventually going to be exposed. And this is important because it's exactly what has happened, Anscombe thinks, with the notion of moral absolutism. The idea that some acts, such as the intentional killing of the innocent or theft, that are always and everywhere wrong. That it doesn't matter if you could save 2 lives by killing 1 person. It doesn't matter if you could save 10 lives by killing 1 person. It doesn't matter if you save 100 lives, 1,000 lives. It doesn't matter how many additional lives you add on. It doesn't justify killing the innocent. And what we'll see in a second is that Anscombe is going to say that the reason why this absolutism, which seems so straightforward to so many ethicists throughout history, has since become a cause of kind of embarrassment and concern, is because we have started trying to defend absolutism by answering questions that we should not have been admitting in the first place. Nevertheless, Anscombe spends a lot of time on these questions. And it's kind of interesting that she spends so much time on these questions, given that she thinks they're nonsense. But this makes sense when you realize that for Anscombe, the recognition of why a question is nonsensical is often the easiest way to get at some really important philosophical insights. I have here about halfway down on the first page of your handout an excerpt from Anscombe's article, Human Essence. Human, I actually didn't look it up when I wrote that title. I think it's Human Essence, but I've not double-checked that. And she says this. Considerations show essence is expressed in a grammar. This is a quote she's taking from Wittgenstein. Considerations of what? Well, for example, of the following absurd sentences. Where does this pencil's uncle live? What is the shape of dust? What is a rainbow made of? How many legs has a tree? Where does a chair feel, do bacteria think? And she says, somehow it's easier to construct examples of sins against grammar than to describe the grammar. Anscombe thinks it'll actually be easier for us to understand why certain questions should not be asked about moral absolutes than it will be for us to understand how moral absolutes really work. And that we'll get our first real grip on this by recognizing which questions we can and cannot ask. And then once we have that sense, we might be able to actually construct a coherent understanding of that concept. But we have to start by understanding the kind of language that's appropriate to the topic in the first place. This, for those of you who know something about Wittgenstein, will recognize deep Wittgensteinian impulses here, thoughts about the mastery of language games and the role that plays in the clarification of meaning as a foundational stage in making sense of what it is that us philosophers are trying to understand. So what question are we going to be asking here? Well, first, let's do a bit of sort of moral history. Anscombe is deeply concerned by what she thinks is a major shift. A major shift from the period in which basically all the greatest ethicists, certainly those that Anscombe would regard as the greatest ethicists, Socrates, maybe Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Epictetus, some other Stoics, Kant even, though Anscombe was not a fan of Kant, they all were absolutists. They all, at least in some places, said like certain things like adultery just should not be done, right? They imply vice in the very name. There's no deliberation to whether they might be right. And what's really interesting is that when these philosophers said these things, they kind of just said it as a straightforward, you know, commonsensical thought. Contrast that to when I give a talk, right? You know, when I go to somewhere like, you know, the St. Louis Action Theory Conference and like give a talk on Anscombe and like there's a question and I'm like, well, you know, for one thing, like, I actually don't think you can ever lie, even to save a life. And then I have to say, but now, like, obviously I'm not going to make any of this hang on this, right? Because obviously that's an absurd thing that I think, but like, I get none of you ever going to believe it. And I'm really sorry that I brought up such an absurd, you know, position here. I have to do this, right, in order to have any sort of credibility. And this itself is a mark of this shift, right? That not only are the greatest ethicists these days, right, your Derek Parfits, your John Rawlses, not absolutists, but even the remaining absolutists kind of feel self-conscious about it in a way that there just wasn't anything self-conscious about Aquinas' absolutism of Kant's, for that matter, right? He had some insane things that, you know, he probably should have been more self-conscious about in his ethical theory. But it wasn't always clear that he was like, you know, that you shouldn't lie was one of them. So where did the shift happen? Why did the shift happen? Well, Anscombe traces it to two influences. And if you read her archival work, you can get this much more precisely, but we're not going to do a sort of deep dive into Anscombe's handwritten manuscripts here. For now, I'll just summarize and say that Anscombe thinks there was a single question that really led us astray. And that is that we started asking the question, why is it so much worse to, here I'm now on the top of page two, why is it so much worse to insert some type of act that violates an absolute constraint? Why is it so much worse to kill an innocent person than to allow 50 innocent people to die? Why is it so much worse to tell a lie than to let myself go to prison? Why is it so much worse to steal this thing than miss out on this amazing concert? We can have all these various questions, and they seem like the sort of question that an absolutist had better have a really compelling answer to. If you're going to say, I can't kill an innocent person even to save 1,000 other people, you better have a really good argument for why it's so much worse to kill one person than to let 1,000 die. Because what else could you possibly point to as your explanation of why in that situation you should not kill that one person, unless there's something about killing that person that's just such a terrible thing that it could not ever possibly be justified, no matter what those consequences would look like. And so this question is a very natural one if your approach to moral constraints, if your approach to moral rules, starts with the kind of model had by someone like, what's an example? I'm blanking on his name. W.D. Ross, right? The kind of threshold deontology of W.D. Ross. He's like, yeah, like, obviously you shouldn't kill an innocent person, but like, lest a nation perish, I don't know anymore. Right. If you start with the assumption that there's just something pretty bad about being dishonest, there's something pretty bad about killing the innocent, there's something pretty bad about these things, then of course you don't do those unless there's something even worse about not doing it. And so if you're going to say you can never do it, It must be in some way like infinitely bad. Like it's worse than anything else you could ever add together. And of course, when you think about it, well, no. Like, I mean, yeah, it's obviously bad to tell a lie, but it's not like the universe is so much worse than me having once told a lie that nothing else could ever compare. And so Anscombe thinks, as long as we accept this question as a good one, unless we can expose this question as in some way ill-formed, we're not going to be able to vindicate our absolutism. So Anscombe thinks that once this question has been admitted, the game is up, and the consequentialist has won. And this is where Anscombe thinks so many contemporary absolutists go wrong, which is they try to play this game. And they try to tell some story about just why it is so much worse to kill one innocent person, right? So why can't you kill one innocent person and save three from dying? Well, because like three people dying, like that happens all the time. Like people just die. But like when you kill an innocent person, that's not just a death, that's a rights violation, right? And like clearly a rights violation, like that's a much more significant evil. And of course you say, well, I mean, but I can't murder one person to stop some other person from murdering three people, right? So I can't stop one rights violation to prevent three rights violations. And like, ah, good point. I mean, but, you know, then it'd be you killing the person. And like, surely it'd be specially bad for you to be the, you know, source of that evil. You say, okay. But like, suppose the only way for me to stay out of the military is to, you know, murder someone. And like, if I end up in the military, like I'll try my best, but like, let's just be realistic. Like looking at the base rates, I'm gonna kill a lot more innocent people. Maybe even intentionally, if like the effect on my character, right, that I worry might happen, will happen. Well, no, you're still not supposed to kill the innocent person. And so you have to tell the story, well, you know, it's really, really bad killing an innocent person right now, right? And so you try to tell these stories about just what it is. You know, Augustine has stories like this, where he's like, well, what's more important, your eternal soul or like the thing you get by stealing? But it's tricky, right? Because now what if I could steal to prevent someone else from stealing? Like, is my eternal soul worth more than theirs? Like, you know, the questions become tricky very quickly. And Anscombe thinks they've become tricky precisely because the absolutist was trying to answer a question they shouldn't have been answering. And so we can point to, and now I'm going to make this a little more precise, three different problems that happen when we try to answer questions like this. The first problem is absolutism just looks absurd. Anscombe has this really lovely quote in one of her unpublished notebooks, where she says, when she's sort of asking this question, where she's saying, like, once people start answering this question, how can we answer? And she says, rhetorically, and you're supposed to have a very clear intuition of the answer, have I truly so great a perception of the dreadfulness of a situation in which murder has been committed that I can say, no matter how much good there might be in such a situation, no matter how much peace, joy, prosperity, personal affection, enjoyment to beauty, and anything else you like to name that is good and fair, the total value of all that, when it includes the disvalue of an act of murder, is less than that of any situation which could possibly have developed if no murder had been done, even though all was strife, sorrow, adversity, hatred, ugliness, and pleasure and ugliness. And someone thinks, no! Of course not! Right? We don't have that intuition. And so if we're going to say you can't murder even to prevent all of that, we'd better have some story to tell other than saying the badness of an act of murder is greater than the badness of all these other things. Another problem, the death of 1,000 epicycles. This was the one I was just gesturing at before. You start by saying like, well, you can't kill one, but I could save more people. Yeah, so it's not just the badness of death, it must be the badness of like you killing or you killing right now. But then you're like, okay, but what if I can like kill right now to prevent my time traveling self from killing three people right now? And you're like, okay, well, right now in like this special causal, and you can keep adding all these additional qualifications that you want. But as you add all these qualifications, all these extra epicycles to try to reconcile your explanation of what's so bad about the act of murder that's prohibited in order to make sure you can't do it even to prevent other acts, that you just end up with this like incredibly gerrymandered, morally obtuse concept that cannot possibly do the work that anyone would want the moral significance of a moral absolute to do. A third problem is that if you're going to have any coherent set of moral absolutes, you better have a lot of sort of formal action theoretic distinctions to go with it. Right? You'll be familiar with some of these things like the act omission distinction or the intention foresight distinction. If you're going to say you can't kill the innocent, well, given that like basically anything we do has an infinite number of causal effects by like, you know, butterfly science fiction stories, there better be some way to distinguish those results in which people die from like the ones that are prohibited. But the problem is once you start pointing to these things, it very quickly becomes odd why we should possibly attach more relevance to them. They seem relevant from the standpoint of constraints, but not from like the amount of evil done. And we can see this if you consider cases where it's not you deciding what to do, but instead you deciding what to prevent. So, you know, I'm a committed Anscombian, I'm married, I don't think I should commit adultery. Not just I shouldn't commit adultery unless someone's life is in danger, I shouldn't commit adultery. But now suppose I know two things are happening on other sides of town, right? It's like a sort of Joker setting up Batman scenario, except this time it's, you know, the Joker setting up the Anscombian, right, as he's wont to do. And on one side of town, there are three innocent kids who are going to die, and the other side of town is my good friend who's about to commit adultery unless I go stop him. And I only have time to make it to one of these. I can stop the adultery, or I can stop the three kids from dying. Not being murdered, but just like dying, I don't know, from a boulder falling on them or something. I guess the Joker messes with that element of it, right? So, you know, scratch that part of the story. I should go save the kids. Of course I should go save the kids. And it doesn't matter that one of these actions was an intentional action or an act as opposed to an omission or anything like that. Those distinctions don't have any kind of relevance for me deciding which of these things to prevent. To give another example, you know, that person over there is about to be killed by a bolt of lightning. That person over there is about to be murdered. It doesn't seem like it's super morally pressing to go stop the murder rather than the bolt of lightning. Because after all, what's bad in those situations? Someone dies. And we want to, we need to, Anscombe thinks, hold on to the intuition that the really bad thing about murder is not that I did some action. It's not that my intention was like against human dignity or something. The really bad thing about murder is that human being is dead. That's the really bad thing. And if you're going to say that's the really bad thing, you would better not tie the badness of murder to things that require these action theoretic constructs like the act omission distinction or the intention foresight distinction to them in order to explain what was so bad that was going on. Not only because you're going to get the wrong answer, because it's actually going to have a pretty corrosive impact on your character when you start to think that like what's really wrong with murder is something it does to my soul rather than what it does to the person who was killed. So, If Anscombe's right that we cannot, the absolutist cannot give a good answer to this question, then the Anscombian had better have a good solution for how it is that we're able to reject the question. She had better be able to tell a story on which this question should not have been asked, and we can really get why it should not have been asked. Because if she can't, then the absolutist needs to admit they're wrong and go home. When they don't, when they insist, you know, because the Catholic Church tells me there are absolutes, but I still need to answer this question, I'm still going to make up an answer that's bad, you're being intellectually dishonest, and it will have a very real and corrosive effect on your soul. Because you're going to start convincing yourself things like, you know, what's so bad about murder is not that people died. So, let's try to figure out if we can reject this question. And here, Anscombe is going to insist that there is a kind of grammatical, right? Now, whenever Anscombe uses the word grammatical, you can replace it with logical if you're a normal, you know, 20th century person, or formal if you read too much medieval philosophy, right? So when I say grammatical, you either replace it with logical or formal, depending on, you know, the relative amount of, you know, Aquinas you read. And she's going to want to say there's a grammatical problem with the question, why is it so much worse to kill one innocent person to let five die? And so she had better be able to show us the grammar, show us not only what's wrong with this, but also why it's so tempting in the first place. And to do this, she's going to draw a distinction between two terms, what she calls on the one hand a reason, that's the reason I had to prevent those three people from dying, and on the other hand a logos, which is a really, really unhelpful technical term she uses that we can just call a kind of absolute for our purposes here. Right. We'd have to qualify that in a little bit, but for now, let's just think we want to distinguish between the absolutes and the reasons and figure out why the grammatical question, why isn't this absolute violation of it worse than this, isn't the right sort of grammatical question to ask. And so here, we can see why we're so tempted to ask this question by noting, and now on the top of page 3, that our moral language, at least on the surface, seems to treat these things as grammatically parallel. So here's an imperative, A1. Don't move that, it's supporting the shelf. Here we're supposed to imagine if you move it, there's going to be a consequence, the shelf is going to fall down. In contrast, don't kill him, he's innocent. On the surface, the grammar here is parallel. And so you start to think, well, if the reason not to move it is it's going to have a bad consequence, namely a shelf falls down and that consequence is really bad, then it must be, if I kill him, it's going to have a consequence, namely that I've killed an innocent person, and that consequence must be really bad. Because after all, these same grammatical expressions exist, and so it must be that there's the same kind of reason going on in both cases. But Anscombe thinks that this is misleading. and that we need to actually recognize is a deep distinction between the kind of normative consideration, the kind of reason, et cetera, that's given in A1 and A2. And to see this, we're going to start with a toy example, right? The case of chess. Because the distinction is much easier to see in the case of a game. And then once we have the distinction in the case of a game, we can try to build it back out to the moral case. So here are two seemingly grammatically parallel expressions. You can't castle this turn, it would remove the defender from the rook. Right, so I'm trying to learn chess, I've got my tutor next to me who's like giving me advice, and like, okay, I think I'm gonna castle. You can't castle this turn, right? It's gonna leave your rook hanging. Okay? Contrast that with, you can't castle this turn, it would castle through check. Those of you who don't know, you're not allowed to castle through check. Okay, it's against the rules. Now, at first these look similar. You can't castle this turn, it'd move the defender of your rook. It must be really bad to move the defender of your rook, so don't castle this turn because it'd have this bad consequence. You can't castle this turn, it would castle through check. It must be a really bad consequence to castle through check. I don't know, maybe it's gonna like cause me to lose a turn later on or something, so I better avoid it. But of course, that's not what's going on with the rule. And we can see that's not what's going on with the rules by noting in this table here, that's below it, that the responses we give to the one just don't make any sense when used as a response to the other. So if someone says you can't castle this turn and remove the defender of the rook, these all make good sense as responses. I'm gonna go through R1 through R4 here. Reply one, true, I agree, it's gonna move the defender of my rook, but if I don't abandon my rook this turn, my queen and king will get forked next turn, better lose my rook than my queen. So if it's an ordinary reason, you can say, yeah, that's bad, but if we don't do it, something even worse is gonna happen and we gotta weigh those against one another. Perfectly sensible kind of reply. Or, here's another perfect sensible reply. True, but even if I protect the rook, I lose it two turns after the fork. I might as well cut my losses while I can still get some compensation. Yeah, bad thing's gonna happen if I do this, but the bad thing will eventually happen anyway, and so, you know, if you all did high school debate, I would use the term non-unique at this point, which is like a language high school debaters really like, but. Reply three, good point. I should first defend with my knight. That way I can get the benefits of castling without endangering my rook. So you're right, this would have this bad consequence. So let's find a way to decouple the consequence from the action. And now it'll be fine to do. And I'll get the best of both worlds. I won't have the bad consequence, but still get the thing I want. Or reply four, look, it's only the loss of one piece. It's not like I'm going to lose multiple pieces. Now, each of these is a perfectly sensible reply to make to someone who says, don't do that, it's going to abandon your rook. But the following are not similarly sensible replies to make to someone who says, you can't castle this turn, it's against the rules, or you can't castle this turn, it's castling through check. One, true, but if I don't break the rules this turn, then my queen and king will get forked next turn. Better break the rules than lose my queen. If you were like playing chess with someone and like you can't do that, it's against the rules, and they say, I know, and like that's bad, and I factored that in, I put that like an 8 centipawn loss, right? But like in the end, right, better than that than lose my queen, you'd be like, what are you talking about? That's not how rules work. Of course, some rules work this way. Like in basketball, there are penalty rules where like the norms of the game actually say strategic fouls are part of the game. But to that extent, they work very differently than other types of rules, right? There are other rules that govern the game of basketball, which you don't regard as sort of open to just sort of calculation of the penalty in the same way. It actually creates like real conflicts here in sports when there's disagreement about whether we regard rules as true rules or penalty rules. My dad got really into golf, unfortunately, a couple years ago. And so I was on some vacation watching this golf game with him. And some person who I don't remember at some tournament, I don't remember, but it was like a big deal in the golf community. He hit the ball up the hill and like it didn't go in the hole and started rolling down the hill. And he was like clearly having a bad day and he just like hit it before it stopped moving. And like the golf world just blew up. Because they were like, you can never do that. He's like, what do you mean? Like, it's a two-stroke penalty. I thought it'd be worth taking the two-stroke penalty to hit it while it was still moving rather than all this stuff. And they're like, the penalty's not there for calculation. It's like, you know, if you accidentally do it, we'll punish you so you couldn't, but like people were incensed. Because some people thought the rules were penalty rules like in basketball, and others thought they were true rules. It's supposed to structure which moves you consider within the game as strategic calculations. Another response that doesn't seem to make any sense. True. But even if I don't follow the rules now, I'm bound to get desperate enough to cheat eventually. Might as well cut my losses while I can still get a good position. Right? Not a response. You know. Or, you know, alternatively, look, You can't castle if you check. I know, but like, let's be real. If I lose this game, my teammates, right, on our, you know, playing their games, they're going to realize we're behind, and they're totally going to find ways to cheat. They're much sneakier than me. And that'd be two cheatings rather than my one. So, like, you had better let me cheat this one time to prevent, you know, your teammates getting cheated even more. What? That's not... whatever the rules of the game are, they don't work that way. Or another. Good point. We should first change the rules. That way I can't castle if you check. And still get the benefit. Let's just change the rules so that you can castle through check. That way, I'll still be able to get the benefits of castling without breaking the rules. Right? Before I said, like, okay, this is a bad consequence, so let's just decouple it. Let's remove that consequence from the action. Now we'll be fine to do both. But it's a bizarre thing to say. Like, you're right, well, we want to be able to castle, but we don't want to castle through check, so let's just change the rules so we can get both of them. Something seems to have gone wrong. Or a fourth case, look, it only breaks the rules once. It's not like I'm breaking three or four rules at once. It's not like I'm both castling through check and while I'm in check or something. None of these replies seem to make any sense. They are, what Anscombe says, grammatically confused. The person who makes these replies, you wouldn't be like, oh, well, let me clarify why it actually is so bad to break a rule. You'd be like, no, you don't know what a rule is. And what they reveal is that the person who makes these replies thinks about rules in the same way they think about ordinary reasons within a game. Namely, that there are bad consequences to certain moves, and we want to try to prevent those consequences all else equal. And so if you think one of the bad consequences of a move is that it's a rule-breaking move, you might be like, well, so we got to like count up just how many rule-breaking moves are we dealing with here in order to assess if the badness is actually worth it or not. But it's not like, no, that, you know, it's wrong to say that that's what's going on. And it's also wrong to say that therefore, like, the breaking of a chess rule has like infinite disvalue. You'll sometimes hear people talk about moral absolutism as though moral absolutism is the view that the violation of certain moral constraints has, like, infinite disvalue. So, like, you know, one person dying, that's really bad. But, like, you know, violating the rule against murder, that's, like, infinite people dying. That's the wrong way to think about it. If you're trying to explain why you can't castle through check, if they're like, look, if I don't win this game, if I don't castle through check, I'm going to lose my queen. Like, it doesn't matter. You're like, I'll lose my queen and my rook. Doesn't matter. And I'm going to be checkmated in four turns. It doesn't matter. And it'll have such damaging effects on my psychology that I will, like, lose my confidence and win all future games of chess. It doesn't matter. And then, like, wow, you mean, like, the strategic downside of breaking a rule is equal to an infinite number of checkmates? No, that's not what I was saying at all, right? I was trying to reveal that your questions were bad, right? Not that you had to, like, up the disvalue to the rule breaking. So I'm now moving on to page four here. Why is there this difference? Well, imperatives like B1, what Anscombe will call reasons, imperatives of the form, you know, you can't don't castle this turn, you'll lose your rook. What they do is they identify some good or bad feature of an action. And in deliberation, what we do is we look at those good and bad features of our action and decide what we're going to do, balancing all those options up. So we look at all our available options, attach these sort of goodness and bad consequences to them, and decide what the best avenue is open to us. But imperatives like B2, you can't do that, it's against the rules, don't work that way. What Anscombe calls logoi don't identify some bad consequence of making a move like this. Properly understood, they just delimit which actions the ones you're supposed to consider the advantages and disadvantages of in the first place. It's not like you have all the options, the cheating ones, the non-cheating ones, and the cheating ones have this extra bit of disadvantage to them, namely the acts of cheating. No, those aren't moves that are actually available for you that you're not supposed to be considering the advantages for and against them in the first place. There was a sort of structural difference between these two things. So that something is against the rules is not one downside among many against that move, but it's just not a possible move at all. My clock's still in Eastern time. That's why it says 7:30. It's actually 6:30, right? Yes. Okay. Great. Now, once we have this distinction, between reasons and logoi, between these two types of considerations, we'll also note that we get a further distinction, a distinction between what we can call the justification and the exoneration of a charge of rule-breaking. This is another very important distinction for Anscombe. So when we talk about reasons, when we talk about, like, downsides, like you're going to lose your rook, we can only talk about things that justify that, right? This is the only way, like, yeah, but, you know, it's worth it. In contrast, when we talk about things like rule breakings, right, breakings the rules of a game, there's two things we could talk about. We could talk about A, it's justified, we're actually justified in breaking the rules in this case. Or we could say, no, it's not actually a case of rule breaking at all. And we mark this distinction quite clearly in our own thought. So I've got an example here. This is about 3C on page 4. Consider two charges of cheating in a 100-meter dash. In ordinary circumstances, runners are not permitted to step outside their lanes. In the first case, imagine that a runner ahead of you wipes out, and you must leave your lane to avoid trampling the other runner. In the second case, suppose that someone has credibly threatened to kill my child unless I give them an amount of money I can only acquire if I'm awarded the race's prize. And suppose this is something I can only do by shaving a few seconds off my time by running slightly outside my lane when no one is watching. In both consequences, if I don't run outside my lane, there's going to be a really bad consequence. We could even suppose that I think trampling this person is going to kill them, right? So we think the like, consequence is going to be the same in both cases, right? Someone dies. Okay. And now someone says, I can't believe you cheated in both these cases. And someone's going to say, your response should be very different. Because in the first case, your response should be, I didn't cheat. It wasn't cheating. I had to get out of the way because he fell. And in fact, I at one point looked up the official rules for the North American track and field thing, and actually did say, if someone's in your way, you can go outside of your track. Right? It just isn't an act of cheating here, right, to get outside of the way. And so here, that I was going to kill this person justifies my getting out of the way, not because it justifies cheating, but because it exonerates me from a charge of cheating. But that's not what we'd intuitively say about the second case. In the second case, where I surreptitiously run outside the line when I know no one's watching so that I can win the prize and therefore use it to buy my child, it might very well be justified. I would think it almost certainly is. I don't think there's a morally absolute, I'm an absolutist about lots of things, but I don't think there's a morally absolute rule against ever cheating in a game, right? That, I think, would go too far. But here what you have is a case where you are justified in cheating. It's not a case where we have exonerated you from cheating. And so we get this really important conceptual distinction for Anscombe once we recognize this unique category, logoi, the things that don't tell you reasons for and against an action, right, but that rule out certain actions. And justification works by stepping outside the kind of delimited space in which you find yourself and saying that actually is okay. And Anscombe would say lots of rules. You can justify disobedience sometimes. Right? Another example where this distinction comes up is the distinction between, on the one hand, in law, between rights of necessity and civil disobedience. So we can imagine a law that says I'm not allowed to do something, right? I'm not allowed to break into someone's cabin, but there's a snowstorm happening outside, and I'm going to freeze to death unless I break into this empty cabin. I can't get permission. And the law says not only will I not be punished, but it isn't even breaking and entering at that point. Right. Some lawyers actually get this wrong, right? If you actually read the legal literature, some lawyers are very clear, it's not even breaking the law. And it's it is breaking the law, but it's okay. But the smartest lawyers, or at least the most correct ones, I really do think, understand that these rights of necessity say you are exonerated from a charge of law breaking. In contrast, there could be other cases of, for example, civil disobedience, where you think this law is really bad, and if we don't, protest this law, people are going to die. And so you break the law publicly and accept punishment. And here someone says, I can't believe you broke the law. Your response should be, look, it was justified in this case. Right? You wouldn't say, I didn't break the law. You might say, I didn't break a just law. Right? We can talk about sort of that complication. It's a really important one. But you did break the positive law. Right? I'm happy to say you didn't break the moral law, but you did break the positive law here in a way that isn't the case of necessity. So in both cases, you do something that on the surface violates the rules of the law. In both cases, you made a correct choice in doing so. But the explanation of what was correct about it is different in the two cases. One was a case of justified wrongdoing, or justified lawbreaking. The other was a case of that exonerates you from lawbreaking. And Anscombe thinks we mark this distinction quite deeply in our recognition of norms of permission and things like this. Right? There is a difference between when my kid says, I didn't really disobey you, and then he's going to, play some lawyer game. He's not old enough to do this yet. Actually, he has tried. He's only 3, but he has done things like this, right? And that's different than I had to. Beth was walking in front of a car, right? I know I'm not allowed to hit her, right? But I had to push her out of the way. Again, he's treated. This didn't happen, right? But there would be a sort of distinction here, right? And we could mark these things. Now, probably in that case, I'd say, actually, you weren't justified in breaking the rules, right? But, then I have to explain to him all about implicit social convention, defining the role of necessity, and that would, have to wait until he's at least 7. So now let's return from games back to ethics. So Anscombe insists that the distinction between A1 and A2 The distinction, if you remember, don't move that, it's supporting the shelf, and don't kill him, he's innocent, is similarly a distinction between reasons and logoi. And that the reason we go wrong in so much of contemporary defenses of absolutism is we keep trying to answer the question in a way that says there's something really, really bad about killing innocent people that we're trying to avoid. And if that's the logic with which you think justifies not doing these things, then you're going to run into a problem. Because we can go through our list of insane replies in the rules of a game and recognize they also seem mistaken if you're thinking about don't kill him, he's innocent, as the kind of rule that Anscombe thinks it is. So true, but if I don't kill an innocent person this time, right, three people are going to die. Well, to the absolutist, that's not a reply at all. It's not that it's, you know, an insufficient reply. It's not that you have to identify more people. It wasn't grammatically a fit reply to the situation. Or true, but if I don't break the rule now, I'm going to break even more rules in the future. It doesn't, like, whatever absolutist thought they were talking about wasn't something that was ever supposed to be bothered by such a response. Good point. We should first change the moral law. Right? That one's a little tricky, but you can imagine cases like this where, like, hey, you can't steal that from me. I mean, you're right, but look, I'm going to do it anyway, so you better just give it to me. Because, like, if you don't, like it's really easy to prevent there being a theft here. You just have to, like, hand it over. Now if I don't have the you don't have the property anymore, there won't be an issue. No, I'm not trying to, like, minimize law. You know, to give another example, if it's bad to break the law in some sense, that differentially says, justifies you changing your actions to fit the laws and lawmakers changing the laws to fit your actions. That it's bad to break the law says you should conform your actions to the law. It doesn't mean so lawmakers should change whatever the laws are to allow this action, because we're not trying to minimize the number of law violations or things like this, and the way we are trying to minimize the number of shelves that fall down. And so if you can change it either by not moving the supporting object or by adding more supporting objects that won't fall, both are equally good solutions to the problem. But it's just crazy to suggest that we have equally good solutions to the problem of listen to the rules or change the rules. Look, it only breaks one more law, not like three. It's not like I'm both killing an innocent person and lying about it. We don't count up the number of rule breakings that are going on. I don't even know how you would do that, right? If I steal your wallet, is that one act of theft? Or like many acts of theft for each individual dollar you have in there? Or like for each atom that comprises your wallet? There's no counting question. There's no sense in which like our moral conclusion would depend on how many acts of theft there are. But of course, if what we're trying to do is the badness of an act of theft, it would make sense to try to add up the number of bad acts of theft there are. But it doesn't. Because whatever kind of normative consideration we're dealing with, it's not one that seeks to avoid some bad consequence, namely a constraint violation. It's instead a consideration that structures those actions which were available to me in the first place to consider the reasons for and against. So by saying this act is the killing of an innocent person, I'm not saying, and this is a really bad thing that you're not going to be able to justify even by pointing out it saves five people. Instead, what I'm saying is, it's not the sort of thing that you're calculating the benefits and drawbacks in the first place. It doesn't matter how many additional benefits you identify, and the same way it doesn't matter how many additional strategic upsides you identify to some move, it's against the rules, those don't count for anything. Some of you will be familiar with like John McDowell's talk of silencing when it comes to moral absolutes, or Joseph Raz's discussions of defeat and preemption. And these are all getting a similar idea. They tend to be somewhat different. They tend to assume there's multiple reasons, properly speaking, and some reasons have a kind of logical priority over other reasons. William says, no, there's actually a grammatical difference between two types of considerations in the first place. I don't want to get into the details of these sort of differences, but they're interesting. And so once you see this is the sort of view that someone like Anscombe or someone like Aquinas have, you also start to explain. Oh, actually, before we get to that point, let's bottom page four, the D2 point. Right, let me just note really quickly, this then explains why our initial question would have led us astray. Because if constraints really are these logoi things, then to know whether asking this question would lead to confusion if we took it seriously, we should ask, would it have led to confusion if we took the game version of this question seriously? And here Anscombe says, well, yes, it very clearly would have led to some sort of confusion. If you were to start with the question, you know, the person says you can't do that, it's casting the check, and you say, well, why is it so much worse to cast the check than to lose a rook? The solution is not to explain what's so bad about castling through check. It's instead to get the person to understand that that question was ill-framed. And to the extent you really do try to answer that question, to the extent you really do convince there must be an answer to that question, to the extent that you start trying to find why, like, I mean, look, if you just lose a game, that's one thing. But, like, if you cheat, that's, like, corrosive to your soul or something. You're very quickly going to start talking moralizing nonsense, Anscombe thinks. By trying to subsume in-game strategic considerations within the structural considerations of the rules of a game, you actually obscure a critical distinction that must be maintained if you want to understand what rules are. So if you really try to answer the question by trying to identify some strategic downside of castling through check, you quickly be left with the conclusion that maybe the rules of chess should not be absolute constraints. Right? Like, obviously, there's nothing infinitely bad about castling through check. So, like, maybe I should try to identify, like, exactly how many empty pawn losses would justify such a thing. Anscombe thinks it's the same mistake, though admittedly a more subtle version of it, that has led modern ethics astray. And this also provides clarity for why these two are so often misunderstood. So let's take, for example, an act of theft. Aquinas and Anscombe both maintain that you should never steal. But anyone sounds like, that's dumb. Because if you're starving, or if your kid is starving, and you can take bread from someone who has extra, obviously you should take bread. And Anscombe and Aquinas both say, well, yes, obviously you should take the bread, but it's not an act of theft. And I have made this move many a time in conversations, right, with philosophers who are not absolutists, and they always accuse me of cheating. Like, it's not like, sure, right? Like, if you're just going to redefine your absolute so as to subsume any consequences, well, of course, but now your absolutism is just like a linguistic game. Right? Like, Aquinas really wanted to say theft is always wrong, and so he said, by theft, I only mean those takings of other things that are actually bad. But no. For both Anscombe and Aquinas, there's a deep distinction between the ways that you might try to see consequences as justifying an action and the ways you might see the consequences of exonerating one from a certain action. And Anscombe and Aquinas both have a very sophisticated story about the nature of property, according to which it's built on conditions of human need, which explain why it does not apply in such cases. Right? Some of you will be familiar with, like, you know, the universal destination of goods and Catholic political philosophy, things like this. The story is, you know, it's quite interesting, right? You would need to tell some story that shows that you were independently motivated to this thought, that internal to the logic of property is this exception in the case of need. But that would require a whole other talk. In fact, a talk I'm giving tomorrow at Purdue for a different TI chapter, right, is literally on famine, affluence, and Aquinas, right, as it relates to these things. But the point is, Anscombe would say you can tell a story here on which what the consequences are doing is exonerating you from a charge of theft and not justifying your act of theft. And this is a very deep and important distinction, and one that is not going to very quickly generalize to other phenomena. Necessity does indeed justify breaking into the cabin at night when there's a snowstorm, but it doesn't justify you killing and eating the last person on your life raft. A necessity defense can only go so far. And when you say that in need you can take something that would otherwise be an act of theft, you're not saying that if the consequences are great enough, theft is justified. So I can take bread to save a child. I can steal medicine if it's necessary to cure my wife. But I can't steal, I don't know, a really nice fishing net, even if it's going to let me find a billion people and give them all a better lobster dinner than what they otherwise would have had. It doesn't matter how good the consequences are going to be. If it's not a case of need, you don't get to justify the act of theft, because the exception was not just if the consequences are good enough, it's not going to be theft anymore. Instead, it was a very particular thing about the internal logic of the nature of property that talked about the nature of human need as it relates to property and luxury. Another example. Anscombe is often accused of not taking the criticisms of absolutism seriously. And for instance, modern moral philosophy, someone's like, I mean, look, Anscombe, like, I get you don't want to kill someone, but, like, even to save 1,000? And Anscombe's like, no, like, I'm not going to answer your question, right? I don't want to engage with it, but it shows a corrupt mind. And people, like, read her as, like, a kind of, you know, grumpy absolutist who doesn't want to, you know, engage with interlocutors. There's actually a nice quote in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that says this. But what Anscombe's doing here is not saying, I don't want to consider the objection. She's saying structurally, no, this is not a consideration at all. You made a grammatical mistake here. Right? If you were trying to say to the person, well, look, you got to castle. I can't. It's through check. You're going to lose your queen. I can't.
It's through check. You're going to lose your queen in your rook. I can't. It's through check. The person is not being kind of grumpy about not taking seriously the new scenarios you're presenting. Rather, the person is just saying something about the kind of considerations that are in play. Now, all this tells us is that there is a kind of logical space for there being a moral law that has absolutes, a moral law that, in the language of Aquinas, distinguishes between precepts and counsels, and in the language of Kant, distinguishes between perfect and imperfect duties, and the language of Anscombe distinguishes between logoi and reasons. It doesn't show us that there are any such absolutes, right? This would something that would still have to be shown. But note that it does show you that anything in the moral law that has this logical category is going to be sort of essentially absolutist. And this at least reveals something really interesting about when you read kind of modern discussions of ethics and when you read kind of classical discussions of ethics. Because when modern deontologists talk, the first question is always like, are you a consequentialist or do you believe in constraints? And once you believe in constraints, then the question is like, well, how strong are your constraints? Are they absolute or are they threshold constraints? Like, is it you can't kill one to save five, or you can't kill one to save 10, or you can't kill one to save any? And no defense of deontology seems to be talking about what the deontology is unless it answers both those questions. First, are there some things you can't do even prevent more of the same amount from happening? And then how strong is that constraint? There's always the second question, and how strong is your constraint? Are you one of those crazy absolutists, or like where do you place the threshold? But you don't see any of that when you read Kant. You don't see any of that when you read Aquinas. And it's a startling difference once you notice that for them, the question was not, first, are you a deontologist, and then what kind of deontologist are you, an absolutist or a threshold deontologist? For them, the question is just, are there moral rules? Are there moral laws? Are there things like don't lie? Not some badness to lying, but things that have the structure of a constraint. And if there are, there wasn't some further question about how strong those constraints are. You never see Aquinas wrestling with the strength of something that has the form of a precept. Once he thinks it has the form of the precept, his answer to the question about whether you can ever do such a thing. At that point, the question just becomes, okay, and what does constitute a lie? The question is never, could a lie be justified, but would it really be a lie if you did this, if you're in a play or whatever? It's never, well, how strong is the constraint against theft? It's, well, but would it be theft if you were starving? You see the same thing in Kant. And it's really interesting that you never see this question, or don't regularly see this question when you read sort of classical stories here, but it's the first question asked when you're dealing with contemporary versions of deontology. And Anscombe thinks that the reason for this is because consequentialism has introduced this question, this why is it so much worse? And that has fundamentally distorted our ability to appreciate what the constraints were supposed to be. And we can have an argument about whether there are any such constraints, Anscombe thinks, but only after we first come to recognize that what she will be arguing for in that debate is something that once you establish there is such a moral rule, the question of what and what justifies the violation of that is just not going to be a live option anymore. Because, of course, we can ask what justifies cheating. And that's because the rules of chess are binding only within a very specified, qualified, kind of idiosyncratic domain of practical reasoning, the practical reasoning of in-game chess considerations. And it's totally possible for me as a human being to step outside of the world of that chess game and ask whether to stay committed to it. But what Anscombe believes, and what Aquinas believes, and what Kant believes, is that there is a broader domain of action which also has things structured like rules. And for that broader domain, there is no possibility of stepping outside it, because that domain is just the domain of human action itself. There's lots more that we could talk about question Q&A with, but I don't want to give a 7.5-hour lecture about the nuances of Anscombe's distinction between all these things. So now I'd like to turn over to questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.